Coming up on This Week on Broadway, we talk with Broadway producer Van Dien. Peter also reviews pieces at Soho Rep, Mary Broom at The Mint, us at The Lion on Theatre Row, and Closer Than Ever once again with a new cast. So please, stay tuned.
I'm the girl men go mad for. Love's a game I can play with a cool and confident kind of air. Just as long as I stay in my own little corner, all alone in my own little chair.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, September 10th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and this evening on the broadcast we have Peter Felicia. Michael is away on vacation. Peter is a writer who you could read at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, Critchaland on Friday, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
So welcome back from your holiday. I understand that you got some good relaxation in and traveled around. You also turned in your book on time, didn't you?
Yeah, I really did. So, I mean, that's over, and I'm very happy. We'll see what the editor thinks about it. But anyway, yes, it is done.
It's done. What's the process for that? Do they come back and ask you to rewrite? And
I hope not. But nevertheless, yeah, there'll obviously be something that will have to be changed or edited out or something like that. That's usually the process. But pretty much, I have to say that if anybody has bought any of my books, like them or not, I'll take the responsibility. I can't say, well, the editor changed that. No, they really are 98-99% what I wrote. So if the new one turns out well, fine. If not, blame me.
Okay. I'm sure that we won't have to blame you at all.
We'll see.
So you got out to see pieces at the Soho Rep, which came out of the Fringe. Is that correct?
Yeah, it did so well that it's one of the shows that was selected to be encored, and I saw it just last night, I think it's pretty fascinating, and I'll tell you why. This is a play about a murder in Hollywood. A mogul has been killed by his young boyfriend who he was just getting rid of. Now, I have just said something that makes it sound like the most boring thing in the history of mankind. but that's not what's interesting about the play at all. Who the murderer is, why it happened the way it did, I have a feeling you'll be able to figure out, as I did too. But this is not first and foremost a murderous mystery, even though you think it's going to be. What this is an examination of gay roles, gay stereotypes, and the way gay people regard each other. And that's what makes it fascinating. The public defender who was asked to defend Shane Holloway, who is not only accused of stabbing this mogul to death, but also sawed him into pieces, hence the title of the play. So the public defender is there, and he's going to do his job. But the public defender is gay, too. And he's been put on this case purposely because he is a gay man. They thought that he'd have more sympathy with what was going on. But what really comes up in this play is the fact that if you're an unattractive gay man, you don't get a fair shake from attractive gay men. That seems to be such an important value among a certain percentage. I'm not saying everybody, a certain percentage of gay men, that you are out of the running from consideration just from the first glance. And our public defender has really had a difficult time of getting a boyfriend, sustaining a relationship, because he doesn't have a face that would launch 1,000 ships or a body that would do that either. So he's a little frustrated by that. He isn't overly frustrated in the sense that he's unreasonable about it or he becomes cantankerous. He's just very much aware of that. Now, there's also a reporter who's on this case, and he's a gay reporter. Now, the question becomes, does he really like our public defender, or is he using him just to get information so that he can get a good story for his newspaper? So that is something that happens as well, but there's a lot of talk about these issues of attractiveness, and because our public defender just doesn't believe that this man is finding, the reporter is finding him attractive for his own self. He's never had that before. And one of the most fascinating lines in the play to me was when he says, you know, everybody's giving money now to the Tyler Clementi fund, you know, the, let's make sure this doesn't happen in schools and all that. Let's really create awareness. And people are writing big checks for Tyler Clementi. But if Tyler Clementi were at a party, nobody would have paid him the time of day because he wasn't attractive enough and he looked kind of geeky. Of course, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and you may not agree with that. And Tyler Clementi may have the music that makes you dance, but nevertheless, I do see that a percentage of people in this country would not have found Tyler Clementi attractive. And as a result, his point is, you know, now that he's dead, we're interested. When he was alive, people wouldn't have been interested. And so there are a lot of pungent issues with this play. Beautifully, beautifully, beautifully acted. Amazing. Jonathan Gibson, these names I don't know at all. Jonathan Gibson played Rory, that's the public defender. Terrific, terrific performance, really memorable. And it's so nice to see a guy who, as I say, is not a model, anything that would really sell papers, anything like that. But boy, what a good actor, you know, and he really does the job tremendously well. I'm also impressed with Chris Salvatore, who played Shane Holloway, the alleged murderer, because he is really beaten down by the system, and you can tell that he's deeply ashamed of what has happened. And yet he's trying to maintain control here. And so he knows the less he tells, the more control he has. And he's looking for the attention of that. So it's a very well-drawn character for reasons like that. A woman named Nina Millen also plays a law official. And she does a wonderful job. She goes head-to-head with Rory quite a bit. So I think that was terrific as well. And Jonathan Nielsen is a character played by Paolo Andino. And he's terrific, too, as a Hollywood executive. Not as high up as the guy who was murdered, but he knew him, and they were friendly, and so he gets drawn into a lot of questioning. And he's an older man, and as a result, you know, there's a lot of talk about the fact that when an older man has a young knockout boyfriend, nobody ever says, wow, that older man must be a stud. That older man must be terrific. Everybody says, yeah, huh, he bought him. You know, he bought the young guy. And that's true. You can't win if you're an old guy. I mean, even if you really do find a young man who loves you for all the so-called right reasons, and nobody's going to infer that when they take a look at you. And it's a little embarrassing when you're an older man to be seen with a younger man from the vantage point. People saying, oh, he's got to have money. He's buying him. So again, a lot of questions here about gay stereotypes, the roles of the gays play, that they feel they should play, forced to play, still some societal issues about being gay. So I was pretty mesmerized by it. Chris Phillips is the playwright. I wish him well. And if we don't hear from pieces, I'd like to see what he's going to write next.
All righty. So that's a great recommendation there. You also got to see Mary Broom at the Mint. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
God bless the Mint. I mean, Jonathan Banks really just sits at his computer and he gets onto IBDB. And there's a little button on IBDB saying previous production, next production. He just starts at the turn of the century, and I don't mean this century. I mean when the 19th turned to the 20th century. And he just clicks away, and if something catches his eye, like he did a play by Gypsy Rose Lee not that long ago. Ironically enough, this is one he did not find on IBDB because it was never produced on Broadway. It instead was done at the Neighborhood Playhouse, and that's the best it got in New York. But it's a foreign play, and it's pretty old. I mean, the New York production was in 1919, and it was actually done in London back in 1911. So it's more than 100 years old now. It's by the writer Alan Monkhouse, and Mary Broom is the name of the maid in the play. And this is a very highfalutin household, very upper middle class, no question, or upper class, really, to be fair. And what has happened is that one of the children in the family, the grown children, has made Mary pregnant. And what's going to happen now? And what's so wonderful is that the boy's mother, a great character, has no prejudice whatsoever that this is a maid, and she is ready to embrace her as a daughter-in-law. She wants to be fair to her. And to watch this woman, who you wouldn't necessarily expect this from, she's not quite a grand dame, but she's getting there. You really wouldn't expect that she would be so welcoming under the circumstances. There would be, oh, horrors, you know, a maid, what a disgrace. Not at all. Not at all, at all, at all. So so that was pretty impressive. The father is a straight arrow, and as a result, he insists that his son marry this woman, or else he's going to cut him off without a penny. That doesn't sound interesting, I'll grant you. It sounds like a situation we've heard many times before. But what makes this interesting is the fact that the son, who really is, if not a 24-carat bum, a 12-carat bum. I mean, he's somewhat irresponsible and doesn't care to work for a living and has a sense of entitlement. But he's not obnoxious about it. And every now and then he'll come out with a dig about marriage or the family or society that you say, you know, the kid's got a point, you know. So it's not a play that deals with black and white issues, even though the maid wears a black and white uniform. But it really does, every character, aside from the father, who is really exactly what you'd expect, is someone worth investigating, because you do find that every time you think you've got the character down pat and say, okay, now I understand, you're thrown a curveball, but never one that makes you say, oh, he'd never do that. I mean, to be frank, in Pieces, there are two things that happened that made me say, I'm not sure he'd do that. But not in this play. I believed it thoroughly, and I think it was done by a very winning cast. Jonathan Banks directed it, too. And if you've never been to the Mint, I will grant you, it doesn't seem like much of a night out on the town. You have to go to 43rd Street between 8th and 9th. You have to get in a small elevator, which takes a million years to get to you where you're going. There are only a few that can fit in the elevator. It's not a glamorous place, believe me. But I'm thinking of all those other theaters that started off in woebegone circumstances, too. And I'm thinking of the Signature Theater, which is now in a glorious new space. And certainly Roundabout. I remember when I was going to Roundabout when it was underneath a supermarket, and I mean that. So so as a result, I think the Mint's time has come that somebody should pick up the slack here and give them a beautiful space befitting the wonderful productions they do. I dare say I have heard about 5% of the plays that the Mint has done before I walk into those theaters. And when I walk out, I'm awfully grateful to Jonathan Bank for doing his homework and finding plays by obscure writers and saying, yeah, let's do it. These are definitely well-made plays, as the expression used to be. Thumping three actors, you know, I mean, that type of thing. This one actually is, if you can believe it, four acts, but they do two and two, so there's one intermission. But a lovely little experience. So I think it's worth taking the slow elevator up to the third floor at 311 West 43rd.
Wow, we're two for two today, aren't we? So another thing to add to our list of recommendations of shows to see. How about, are we going to go three for three with Us, which is they subtitle itself a progressive love story. It's playing at the Lion on Theater Row. Tell us about Us.
Say two out of three ain't bad, you know, so Us. It's written by a woman who also stars in the play, and it's about politics. And the opening lines are really her, this woman going crazy and being very profane, yelling and screaming at her husband because she found out that he's been cheating on her. And what had happened was he's a political candidate, and he's not happy to think that his wife will not be joining him in that wonderful photo op that happens at every political convention where the wife is there dutifully waving along and smiling. So that's the issue. I'm afraid it doesn't go anywhere of interest. And to be perfectly frank, The 90-minute show, when I first looked at my watch and figured, well, you know, 10 minutes to go. We were only at the 40-minute mark. So by the time we got to the 70-minute mark, I decided, gee, I wonder if I've seen a show in foreign lands for every letter of the alphabet. Let's see, Art in Barcelona, yeah. Vienna, and, you know, I went through the list. I didn't find an E, I didn't find a G, I didn't find an X, needless to say, because I've never seen Xanadu anywhere outside New York, New Jersey. But, I mean, it was that type of play. The people were decently performing these very 1.5, 1.4 dimensional characters. So I thought it was one of the worst things I've seen in a long time. And I can't ever recall being at an 90-minute show that went so slowly. So I would definitely say that Us is not worth seeing, because it goes exactly with politics. I mean, doesn't the setup sound, you know, like something you've heard before? The politics. Fooling around, and the wife who finds out, and, you know, and they have to keep up appearances and all. I mean, after all, he's not running for president, by the way. He's going to be a senator. And this, by the way, it takes place in 2008, so there's lots to talk about Obama. There's lots to talk about McCain. Not very much talk about Sarah Palin, by the way. So there's issues like that, and I know that it reaches occasionally to say something pungent about relations that politicians have and what's happening in the country, and it wants to mirror things like that, but I found it very tedious. Frankly, if it has a dynamite ending, you know, it may very well have a terrific ending. But by that point, I was up to Run for Your Wife that I saw in Italy, you know, in 1776 that I saw in Canada, you know. So I wasn't at all interested in it. And I could not wait for it to end. I will say that I had some friends there that night who didn't think it was nearly as bad as I did, though they didn't like it. So anyway, I cannot recommend Us. I don't think they would either.
All righty. And to end off our reviews, you got back again to see Closer Than Ever because they had a cast change over at the York. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was really nice to go back and see the two new ladies. One is Jacqueline Piro Donovan, and the other one is Julia Murney. And it was really so nice to see the show again because it's so intelligent. You know, I love intelligent musicals. And nobody's better than Richard. Nobody really, seriously, is better than Richard Baldwin. We're coming up with ideas for songs, the dealing with the contemporary situation about love and romance. And there's a song about a stalker, in which the guy's saying, what am I doing here? You know, that type of thing. A real estate agent to a woman who is really very randy and enjoys having a good time with some of the people who come in to rent. When she shows them apartments, well, since we're here, you know, why not avail ourselves of the opportunity to do many other things. A song about old friends that taking us through 15 years of their relationship and how their friendship breaks down, not fatally, but just the way you have friends and you get busy and you don't get a chance to see them as often as you do. And even though when you're kids, well, not kids, but I mean like people in their 20s, you expect that the relationship is going to be exactly the same. It isn't, you know, so what can you do? I mean, nobody's to blame. It happens. A marvelous song called One of the Good Guys that Salva Viana was still singing. He was part of this company when the show opened in June, about a guy who's never cheated on his wife, you know, but in a strange way, he's paying for it because he's wondering what he missed. You know, there used to be that old oil filter ad. You can pay me now or pay me later, you know, depending, you know, when you change your oil filter. I'm afraid sex is like that, too, that if you don't pay Mr. Sex when you're a young kid, you start obsessing about it as you get older, thinking what you've missed. So anyway, Jacqueline Piro Donovan is really quite good. She has a wonderful presence. She has marvelous red hair that she uses to accent what she's she's doing. A terrific smile, a very winning way. And I really enjoyed her very much. Julia Murney, I enjoyed. And she certainly did well in Miss Bird, the song about the real estate agent. But, you know, it's so wonderful. This has turned out to be a very surprising hit for the York Theatre Company. It was only supposed to run for a few weeks, and then they extended through June. Then they extended, you know, through September. And Jim Morgan, who really deserves such credit for doing such yeoman work and keeping that company alive. I mean, Janet Hayes Walker was the founder of it, and she died, I'm sorry to say, of cancer. And he said, we are going to keep this in Janet's memory. And he's done it. You know, they're still there and in the Citibank building. And it's a nice, cute little space to watch a show. Very cleanly done. And I'm very glad that now it is extended through November 25th. So I don't think that's going to be that much shorter than the original run. So, and wouldn't it be nice if it could even eclipse the original run when it was done in 1989? But sprightly songs, you know, intelligent songs, tuneful songs. You may go out remembering a melody or two, and that's really good too. So, but mostly about contemporary life, you know, and it's going to be very hard for anybody to go there and not identify with one, two, three, or seven of the songs that they hear. They'll say, yeah, I've felt that way. I've been that person. I've known that person. So Closer Than Ever is definitely still worth seeing. The two new ladies do the material proud, and George Dvorsky and Sal Viviano are really quite good. So I do think it's a lovely evening, and not only that, I just love hearing the audience listening so hard, paying attention, because the lyrics come fast and furiously, and they're rewarded with a number of big belly laughs for their trouble and really paying attention. So so good for Maltby, good for Shire, good for everybody.
Great. So we have three out of four to add to our list this week. Somebody was saying that they hate listening to our show because it costs them so much money. Because they have to go see everything that we talk about. So in the news this week, we have just a few things we're going to touch upon. We had an announcement that Jerry Zaks is going to be directing a show called Human, which is coming to Broadway in 2013-14. That's still a long ways away. It's a strange announcement to come so far away, but it's it was written by Academy Award nominee Charles Palmieri, who also wrote A Bronx Tale, and so I guess we look forward to that. Peter, have you heard anything else about the show?
No, I haven't heard anything that, you know, like, boy, I heard a song, or I went to a backstage audition, or somebody sent me a demo, nothing like that. But I will say that I lived not far from the Broadway theater, the one where Sister Act was playing, and passing by at night, I would often see Jerry Zaks hanging around, and we would talk, and he'd say, you know, I just can't stay away. I love this show. And I thought that was so wonderful. So I think Chaz is lucky to have Jerry Zaks, who, if he loves your show, really gives the time and attention and care. And I'll be frank, Jerry loved Sister Act far more than I did, but maybe one of the reasons it was around for as long as it was had to do with the fact that Jerry cared about it and certainly paid attention to it, because shows can really disintegrate if the director isn't around. So so I wish Jerry well. I really do. I always have, and I think he's an honorable man and works hard for his cause. And you know, I remember when Sister Act when I saw it at the Broadway, and I had seen it in London, I had seen it in Pasadena, coming up the aisle at the end, I had to meet somebody at my apartment to let him in, an out-of-town visitor. So I left while the curtain calls were happening. And the expression of delight on his face that I saw while he was at the very end of the theater, the last row, standing by the last row, that he was just so pleased and happy. I remember that much more, frankly, than I remember Sister Act. So if Jerry likes it, he's worthwhile. You know, I also made him cry once for a very different reason that usually implies. I said to him, I love the story of when you were at Dartmouth and you were just getting involved with theater, and they cast you in the Chorus of Wonderful Town. And All right, so he's an ensemble member. He doesn't have a moment to himself, all right? And he, as reported, what he said was that when he looked at all the costumes he had, when he was playing in the sailor suit in the conga line, when he had to be a policeman in the scene where Eileen is held by the police for a night, when he had to play a citizen of Christopher Street, and all the, he had like six costumes, and he said, "Wow, look at all these costumes, and they're all mine." And you know, other people, I'm just in the chorus, you know. Oh God, you know, yeah. But the idea that he was playing so many roles appealed to him, and that's very interesting, of course, because it could be effectively argued that directors play all the roles in the show. So as a result, it was good training for the director he became.
That's a great story. We got a slight reprieve. I don't know if you heard while you're on vacation, but Dress Circle got a 6-month reprieve, and they're going to stay open for another 6 months at their same location. So that's always good. So if anybody's heading over to London, you have another 6 months to visit the acclaimed shop that is Dress Circle. Hey, Peter, have you heard about this Broadway or Bust special on PBS?
I did an article about it, and I didn't see it last night, I have to admit. But I did talk to the producer, and I was slightly involved with that competition this year. I went up to Rochester to judge the Rochester final.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And I went to the Jimmy Awards, as they're called, and I'm just so glad these things exist, because the idea that high schoolers are able to get on a Broadway stage is tremendously exciting. And there is a 3-part series. It started last night on PBS, and I'm very happy to say that it was done by WGBH in Boston, which is a station that I know well because of my connection with Boston. And I just love very much hearing that that they were the ones who said, "Yeah, let's do this, let's make it happen." So it's really being done in 3 different parts, and the first part, is the shakeout, and it goes the way you'd expect it to. But I talked to 2 kids from Jersey, they have very different stories. Michael Ferlita was the Jersey boy who won the Rising Star Award at the Paper Mill Playhouse. In fact, he played Jekyll and Hyde. And he had a wonderful time. He didn't win, but now he's going to criminal justice. That's what he's majoring in. He's going to a college and majoring in criminal justice. You know, it was great fun, but it's just one of those things. You know, it was a wonderful high school activity. I'm thrilled I did it. What fun. But it's not going to be his life. While the girl from New Jersey that I spoke to, Morgan Kerner, has a very different story. She is raring to go. She's now starting her freshman year at the Boston Conservatory of Music. And for her, it really is Broadway a bust. She is determined to get there, and I wouldn't bet against her. I looked in the program after I spoke to her, and she really is quite pretty. And not only that, I mean, she won the Rising Star Award at the Paper Mill Playhouse, which is their own, you know, the highest award you can get in Jersey if you're a high schooler. And she played Cinderella in Into the Woods. Now, think about that. That is not a big role. And to really make that big an impression, to win over kids who were probably playing Elle Woods in Legally Blonde, you know, maybe Eliza Doolittle, you know, who knows, Maria, either Maria the Puerto Rican or Maria the Nun. I mean, you know, the Eyes of Cinderella doesn't have that much stage time compared to real leads in musicals. So for her to make this grand an impression, she must really be someone. So I'll tell you this much. There were 60 kids in competition, 30 boys, 30 girls. And the night that the Jimmys were held at the Minskoff, they limited the next cut down was 3 boys, 3 girls. So a lot of kids got eliminated very quickly. And when one boy came out and sang, I'm not going to tell you what, because I want the suspense to be there and I want people to watch the series. It was clear as crystal from the thing he selected, the song he selected, that the other two might as well not even come out and do anything. And I'll leave that with people to entice them to see the three-part series, because I think you'll agree that his choice of material was so brilliant that the other kids didn't have a chance. That was fun. They actually followed these kids through a week, because these kids had a week of training. They stayed at the NYU dorms, and they had classes every day. And what they were doing was practicing an opening number and closing number. And then what all the kids did was come and sing about 16 bars, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, of the of a song that they from the part that got them there in the first place. So so Michael Ferlita, who did Jekyll and Hyde, did the Alive song, and Cinderella did some from On the Steps of the Palace. So it was quite a thing, you know. It's just very nice seeing those kids up there in this wholesome activity. And God bless Jimmy Niederlander for being behind this, and that's why they called the Jimmies, and that's why it was held in Niederlander Theater, needless to say. So so I'm sure, frankly, I'm looking forward to seeing them all in one fell swoop. I'm going to watch the three-part series 3 hours in a row, and watch it that way.
Yeah, for those of you who aren't going to have this broadcast in your area on PBS, for international listeners or some folks who don't have a PBS that's going to broadcast this, if you go to BroadwayRadio.com, there's a link there called Broadway or Bust, and it brings you to the PBS website section of the Broadway or Bust. You can watch them all online right there. But hopefully it'll show in an area by you. But they're wonderful series. I'm actually going to talk to Lizzie Calloway to see if I can get her to come join us one day to talk about her involvement in Broadway Bust. So,
and she told me that she hopes this will be an annual event, that they will follow it every year. And I hope that's true. That'd be really nice for kids. And again, you know, it's so interesting to me. I'm the critic in residence at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, which is certainly one of the best schools in the land for creating Broadway talent. Ashley Brown, who was Mary Poppins, went there, and plenty of other kids. Karen Olivo, who won the Tony for West Side Story. Plenty of kids have gone there and done very, very, very well. But my point is, so many of the kids I've talked to, I said, how'd you find out about the school? They said, well, you know, I would look in Playbill, and I would see that so many bios said she is a graduate of CCM, you know, and okay, let me investigate that school. I'm hoping that Broadway or Bust will serve the same type of purpose. The kids will see this and say, wow, there's such a thing as Rising Star Awards? There's such a thing as this? I've got to find out about this. I've got to get into this. And that will be wonderful to have kids have that extra focus.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, such a great program. I'm really excited about it. Other things in the news was the announcement that Norbert Leo Butz is going to be starring in Big Fish, which I thought that we had heard before, but I guess maybe this makes it official. I thought that we had heard that Norbert was doing it already, but it seems that it was big news this week, and I'm looking forward to Big Fish. It's got quite the cast and talent involved with it, so you know, we'll see what's going to happen towards the end of the season when it's going to come in. Speaking about the end of the season, there was a report on New York One that the Tony Awards might be coming back to Radio City Music Hall.
Good and bad. What's good about it is there is some people who just see the Tony Awards live, and this will give them the opportunity to do this. They've been shut out for 2 years at the Beacon because of seating capacity. Yeah. So, though most people I know who go to the Tonys and actually sit there, I'm usually in the press room, tell me that they much prefer the Beacon because it's much more intimate. It's not a small theater, but it's certainly smaller than Radio City. But, you know, I think every person who's interested in theater should go to the Tonys at least once. The wonderful thing about the Tonys is you are with people who care as much as you do. And that's having that validation there, just having people surrounding you who are interested and who wins Best Featured Actor in a Play, you know, I mean, as opposed to, you know, people sitting at home who've never heard of these people. So so everybody should get the chance to do it. And that's the good thing about Radio City. It gives everybody a chance to do it. And so if it does come back, good for that.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Peter, if we talked about it while you were away or if you were here, but a couple of weeks ago we talked about the producers of the Tony Awards had decided not to renew their contract, and it's gone on to new producers. I wonder if it's the new producers who have decided to try to get back into Radio City or what, but I'm sure we'll hear more about this as the story progresses. One of the things that we might not see at the Tony Awards this year, it's a possibility, is Rebecca, the big musical coming in. Lost a major investor who passed away and who had reportedly a $4.5 million investment in the show. So the rehearsals were scheduled to begin, and they got pushed back, and the first preview on October 30th, I think, also got pushed back, and I guess the opening night will get pushed back, but this is quite a blow to a show that's trying to make it in, and we had big drama last season as well, didn't we?
Yeah. Supposed to already see it last season, and you know, it might have done well last season since the competition was considered beatable last year for the Tony Awards. So it may have hurt them tremendously. One of the points I made in my book about Tony losers was that Chicago was supposed to come in the 1974-75 season, but Bob Fosse had a heart attack. And as a result, it had to be postponed a season. So instead of its competition being The Wiz, which I believe Chicago would have beaten hands down easily, Chicago had to go up against a Chorus Line. And as a result, Chicago then set the record, it's since been eclipsed, of 11 nominations with no wins whatsoever. And obviously the year before, it would have done very handsomely, I dare say, against The Wiz. So it's really, sometimes these postponements could really be very costly. And we have no idea, of course, if the musicals this year are going to be any better or worse than last year. But nevertheless, we do know that a lot of people felt that once Newsies, you know, those two shows were beatable. And, well, certainly Newsies was, obviously. But who knows if this is going to work in Rebecca's favor or against Rebecca. But, you know, the idea of a show that keeps postponing, you know, the public starts thinking, well, if they can't even get it together, how good can it be? You can't give the public too many excuses to not buy a theater ticket. They'll take everyone they can get, you know, rather than put out the money, you know. And considering what the prices are, how obscene they are, there's no question whatsoever that people do look for excuses not to have to spend money on a show, and that they'll only spend money on the things that really seem like lead pipe cinches. When I've gone to have checkups recently, and you know, what's good, the doctors say to me, and you know, I'm very reluctant to recommend anything. I don't know their taste, but you know, even if I'm worried about a doctor spending that much money for a show, well, you know, then the price is really out of sight. So I think Rebecca is really, really going to have a hard time, and I won't be surprised if we never see it at all. And I think that's, in fact, a very easy prediction to make.
Well, the people that can answer those questions are generally Broadway producers, and we have one with us this evening, Van Dien. Van is a Tony Award-winning producer of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. He also has three other Tony Award nominations for the revivals of Vida, Gore Vidal's The Best Man, and for Catch Me If You Can. His other Broadway credits include the new musical Bonnie and Clyde and David Henry Hwang's Chinglish. He's also a producer of Masterclass with Tyne Daly in London's West End. Van is the co-founder of the Broadway Consortium and Broadway Records. He's the lead producer of Off-Broadway's Rooms, A Rock Romance, which also got Outer Critics Circle and Helen Hayes Award nominations, as well as A Saint Heaven and Alive in the World. Van also designed artwork and packaging for Broadway cast recordings, and two that were Grammy nominated. His websites can be found at www.broadwayconsortium.com and www.broadwayrecords.com. So, Van, good evening. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for the great introduction.
Yeah.
Well, broadwayrecords.com, that must have been a hard domain to get.
I was. We had to buy it off somebody, actually, in order to get that. Somebody had been squatting it, as they say.
I tried to buy that domain many, many years ago.
Oh, I see. If it hadn't happened, what would you have called the company?
Not sure. I mean, we had some other ideas, but they seemed to be taken. Like, I thought about Opening Night Records and Ovation Records, but both of those, I believe, are taken.
BroadwayRecords.com is a perfect name for a company that does what you're doing. And some folks would say, why? Why would you get into this Broadway cast recording market, which is fraught with losses?
Well, it is a tough market. I definitely can't deny that, but it's a matter of trying to find ways to do it in the new world that we live in. I think there are smart ways to try to go about it, and there's also a synergy with being a Broadway producer, because there are certain shows that you work on that wouldn't get a cast album unless you make it happen. And, you know, case in point is Bonnie and Clyde, when it closed a little bit sooner than we all hoped. It made it a lot tougher to actually put a cast album together. So I led the effort, and it actually launched our record company by doing it, to create, a cast album for it, which is going to lead to a much longer and more fruitful life than it might have otherwise had, because when musicals don't have cast albums, it's very hard for anybody to discover them or to understand what it was on Broadway.
Some years ago, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels did their own album and then gave it out to people who came to the theater. Have you heard if that was a good idea? Do you have any sense of if that was a good idea?
Well, for them, it was more of a promotional thing, because, of course, the show was still going on at the time. So I think doing that and, I think they limited the quantity, so it didn't cost them too much, but I think it was probably a smart promotion. I know Book of Mormon did something reasonably similar, where they gave copies for 99 cents for a very short period. I think they might have been mostly digital, but that helped skyrocket them on the Billboard chart and everything. So,
which brings up a good point. Are you selling more digital copies of Bonnie and Clyde or hard copies?
We're doing both.
I know, but so far, which has done better?
It's been about almost 50-50, actually.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Good. Have you any interest in recording shows from the past?
Potentially. It's something we've talked about.
Are there any shows from the past that you love that you would love to record?
Trying to think of those that haven't been recorded before. There's certainly a lot of shows that I love in the past that might be nice to take a fresh look at. There aren't too many that have gone unrecorded that I can think of at the top of my head. That I'd be interested in. I know recently, I guess, Crybaby, I don't think, had a recording, and I'm sure
right,
a few
it
others.
Did not, yeah. Uh-huh. But I mean classics like The Golden Apple or Love Life, which certainly people of my generation have been waiting a long time for cast albums. do you know about these shows, or do you have any interest in making these happen?
I do. In fact, there's another one, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I don't know if that has either. It's definitely something. What's that?
There was no album for that. Not really. There was something that came out later called White House Cantata, which really doesn't count because it's a murderously awful recording. And somebody saw 1600. Believe me, it's a much more spirited score than that album leads us to believe. So we always hear that the Bernstein Estate is very difficult about that show, and they don't want it to be recorded as it was performed. So have you run into any roadblocks yet about from people saying, no, I don't want that to happen?
Not yet. We've been fortunate. I mean, we haven't tried on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, so I can't report on that one. But so far, I mean, people have been cooperative. They want to, as long as they feel that it's being treated well and, and with love and care, I think they're very interested in whatever helps promote the material.
Whenever a novice enters into a new business, there's always something he didn't remotely see coming down the pike. What's been the biggest surprise for you as a record producer?
I'm trying to think on that one. I think we'll just maybe how small the world is in that genre, because it used to be to be a record company, you have to have a major distributor in order to get it in the stores, but sadly there aren't that many stores left, and they're getting fewer and fewer all the time, with Colony just announced that it was closing, and Dress Circle in London. Those were two of the major stalwarts that were still around, and unfortunately are about to be no longer. So it's really a very small world, and it's mostly either digital or online sales.
Speaking of that, is Bonnie and Clyde on Spotify?
It is.
Good. Good. That's
Peter,
nice.
You know what Spotify is?
Yeah. That's the prize.
Wow. I'm shocked. That's great.
You know, a broken clock is right twice a day. So I mean, this is my chance to shine on this. They don't have all that many cast albums, comparatively speaking. It seems to me. The other night we were looking for Superman, and it wasn't on there. And I was told the 20th Century just came on the other day, but up until like this weekend, it wasn't available. So anyway, recording session for Bonnie and Clyde. Did you do it in a day?
We did. In fact, what we decided to do was do it a couple days after the show closed, in order to give everybody a few days off, but not so much time that people might be off on vacation or to other parts of the country. So we wanted to make sure everyone was still in town. But we gave them a couple days to rest, and then did it all in one day, and went extremely well, and we're really pleased with how it came out. I think everybody really knocked themselves out to do absolute best album they could.
Has anybody stepped forward and said, I've heard your album, I think this is a great score, I'm interested in doing a production in my hometown? Anything like that?
There have been some inquiries about that. I mean, right now it's not in the licensing phase quite yet, because we're still looking at some other options about future life for it.
So you haven't signed with one of the four major companies or any of the minor companies. Do you get involved with that, in fact? Is that a call that you make, or is that simply an author's call?
That's actually usually the lead producer in conjunction with the authors. That wasn't the lead on Bonnie and Clyde. Jesse Richards and his partners would be more in charge of that aspect.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So, speaking of small worlds, as you were talking about in the music producing industry, Broadway is sort of a small world for Syracuse alum. And I noticed that you're a Syracuse alum, and there's lots of you must feel quite at home with seeing familiar faces.
I do. In fact, our lead in the album for this is Estrada Jones. Patty Murin is a fellow Syracuse alum, and there's many others that are on both the producing and acting side. So it's quite a good group that we have.
Were you involved in the theater program up at Syracuse?
I was. I took some courses there, and I went to most of the shows that they put on. I wasn't officially a member of the program, but kind of built my own program of studies, and I sprinkled some theater courses in it.
What did you study?
Television and film production.
Oh, so as people mostly head from Broadway to television, you headed the opposite direction, from television to Broadway?
I did, and I also took a lot of music courses, music industry, a business, basically my own kind of custom program of classes that really actually prepared me pretty well for what I ended up doing later on.
All right, but were you natively interested in Broadway to begin with?
I was. In fact, my senior thesis was a Broadway musical, or that type of musical. Obviously, it wasn't on Broadway at that point, but I'd written a musical book, music and lyrics, and turned it into a film so that it would qualify for my senior thesis. And
wrote way. So it was an original, not an adaptation?
It was an adaptation of a lesser-known Bronte novel.
My. Called what?
Anne Bronte, who's one of the lesser-known sisters.
Oh, how funny. I didn't even know there was an Anne Bronte. So,
Charlotte didn't really want people to know about her because she didn't think her novels were befitting of the type of thing that a young woman should write. But, it was kind of ahead of its time.
Do you mean it was hot stuff?
I'm sorry?
Was it hot stuff?
It was more that it dealt with alcoholism and other things as well. And she didn't. I don't want to speak for her, obviously, but
sure.
My understanding was that there were certain aspects of it that she didn't think really reflected Anne's personality, so she didn't really want it out there.
My friends in Providence are looking forward to seeing Catch Me If You Can. Are you involved with that non-equity tour that's going out?
I'm not directly involved with the tour, but I'll be there supporting it, and I look forward to seeing the production in Providence, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So after you got, after you graduated Syracuse, I guess in 96 or so, where did your life take you after that?
Well, I started my own business in computer programming, actually, creating custom software and websites and that sort of thing. And was doing that for a while and writing, because my original interest in theater was on the writing side, as I mentioned, with my thesis and everything. And then had an opportunity back about 7.5 years ago to go to a backers audition, which I took the opportunity because I thought any time you can learn more about the business side, it's always a good idea.
How interesting. And, what was the show?
Well, it was an off-Broadway show called Once Around the Sun.
I remember that.
And I really liked the music. And, you know, it was one of those things where, because we knew one of the producers, we thought, well, if we, you know, put a small amount in, maybe, you know, we can be a fly on the wall and really learn about the business. And the irony, actually, is that I immediately got my first producing gig at the New York Musical Theater Festival right after that, and then didn't have time to ever be the fly on the wall that I intended to be. But I got something that was more hands-on. So in the end, it was even better in that I got to experience being a producer right away and kind of get thrown into the fire, which is a good way to learn.
We had a lot of controversy this summer about the New York Music Theater Festival. Do you recommend it? Is it a good deal? Are you happy with it?
Well, I think it's a great way for works to really get a lot of attention, because certainly a lot of major people go to it. We found rooms at the festival the same year I produced my first show that I mentioned. I also went to see some of the others, and Rooms was one of them, and we ended up picking it up and ultimately taking it to Off-Broadway and doing an album. So it definitely has launched a lot of shows, and, you know, Next to Normal, among others, that have made it all the way to Broadway.
One of the hardest things for a producer is to ask for the check, because a lot of people are reluctant to put money in show business. Sitting Bull in Annie Get Your Gun says, never put money in show business. And I imagine you hear that from time to time, that people unconditionally, automatically will turn down anything about show business. Do you see that type of resistance across the board, or is that not something, I mean, people just view things by a case-by-case basis?
I think that there's certainly some people who won't invest in theater, but they may not understand it, or if they're in it just for the money, then theater's probably not for them, because it's really about more than just that. It's about, you know, the experience and, you know, being a part of it and you know, learning more about the industry. And we find that every investor has a different reason for wanting to do it. Some of them have kids that they want to expose to the inner workings of theater, and others used to be actors or involved in some way in the past and want another way to kind of experience it again and to be involved with it. I think you're not necessarily going to get Wall Street people whose sole purpose is just the bottom line. Although the reason we actually created the Broadway Consortium was to target some of the people who might not feel as comfortable otherwise, because what we do is our investors actually invest in our company, and then our company invests in and produces shows. So that means they own our entire portfolio of shows, which helps lessen the risk, because it's spread across many shows as opposed to...
So in other words, just for the sake of argument, if I put money in with you, and I love the idea of being in Porgy and Bess, but I don't like the idea of being in Evita, too bad, right? I have to invest in both.
Well, basically you're investing in the company, and then we apportion it. So you are technically involved in both, but it's you only invest one time, so it's not like you have to put in more each time.
So were you heavily involved with this new Ricky Martin thing about doing fewer performances a week to add on to his run? Were you in the meetings on that, or was that a big deal? Did you come up with the idea, in fact, Ricky, you know, do fewer and do it longer?
Well, I can't take credit for the idea. It was, you know, came from the lead producers, I imagine. I wasn't privy to the inner workings of that discussion, but I was aware of it and supportive of it.
Mm-hmm. So any plans? Have you been looking around for replacements when January comes?
Well, there's talk about that. In fact, we're having a meeting shortly to, you know, discuss what comes next.
So tell me, about what's coming next. Do you have a bunch of projects lined up for either recording or for Broadway that's going to be coming up soon that we should know about?
Well, we have both. Some of them we're not quite ready to announce yet, but on the recording side, we're coming out next week with Laura Asness, her first solo album. It's a live album recorded at the Cafe Carlisle.
The thing about Laura Osnes is that not only is she ugly, but she's not got no talent either, mm-hmm. right? You know? Isn't she amazing? I mean, did you know her before, Bonnie?
I did. I didn't know her personally, although we had friends in common. But Bonnie and Clyde was the first time we actually got to work together, and it was such an amazing experience that when it came time to for her to do her first album, it was a natural fit for us to work together. And I am thrilled about that because being on, you know, the ground floor for somebody, you know, of that level of talent is a true honor, and it's great for our company as well.
Where did you meet up with her before Bonnie?
Well, we had friends in common.
Friends in common, okay.
Including some of the folks that were on the reality show that was used to cast Grease back, you know, way back when.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. So what else have you got other than Laura's album coming up?
Well, we have a new Jekyll & Hyde concept album.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Oh, are there many changes happening from the score we all know?
There are some, including the orchestrations. It's a bit more modern, and it's really done a fantastic job with it. I'm very pleased.
Who's the new orchestrator?
Well, Jason Howland did the new arrangements and orchestrations.
Uh-huh.
You know, in conjunction with Frank, of course.
Uh-huh.
Jason also did the old ones, though, or with Kim Schoenberg, but... But
Jason's always working with Frank.
Yeah.
So, is Bring On the Men back in the show or?
Actually, it's on the album. I'm not sure if it's in the show because I'm not involved with the show directly. Although they just had their opening night down for the tour down in La Mirada, California.
And what have you heard?
I've heard you know, very positive things. It's a bit of a new approach to it, and I think people are very pleased. And yeah, they have their official tour opening in San Diego. La Mirada is kind of their chance. It's almost like the preview portion.
Constantine's going to be a different way to market that show outside of the traditional Broadway audiences. So that'll be interesting to see how it tours. You know, sort of like the American Idol tours that go around the U.S. If they'll market it the same way.
That, and of course Deborah has quite a following herself, and mm-hmm. got through all of her albums that she's had that have been you know, chart toppers, so she's definitely got a pretty big fan base also.
All right, I don't mean to embarrass you, but obviously you would have had a chance to be one of the producers of this and you decided not to. Can you tell us why?
I was more just that we had our plate full. We already had set what our next season was going to be, and we were not prepared to take another one on yet, but it actually, the model that they've chosen and the way that they're financing is actually really smart, and the way they're, you know, have it structured with the tour leading into Broadway and the details of how the numbers work and the financing is, you know, it's a very smart business model. So it was very attractive. I wish I could have been in a position, you know, to add that onto our roster.
Okay. Masterclass. Did you see it at the Friedman and said, gee, this would be great for London? How did it happen?
Actually, I hadn't seen it in New York, surprisingly, but I had met with a number of the producers, and I had read the script and, you know, knew the reputation of everybody involved. And so it came about more from that end of it. But it was, if I'd known, of course, that I would have that opportunity, I would have seen it in New York as well, but I didn't get the chance to.
Mm-hmm. Has it done well over there?
It got a pretty good response, and the audiences liked it. It didn't sell quite as well as we were hoping. It's always had a tough time in London. I think it seems to do better in New York.
So it's already closed?
It was a limited run. So
I see. I've had lovely dealings with Tyne Daly. Did you?
I'm sorry?
I've had lovely dealings with Tyne Daly. Have you?
Yes. Yeah,
she was good to you?
Yeah, she's great. She's really down to earth and extremely dedicated to her craft.
So the Broadway Consortium, if somebody wanted to become involved with involved with meeting with your company to invest or something along those lines? Is it an open-ended investment, or is this strictly for a group of musicals that you've put together in whatever type of corporate structure you're doing?
Well, it's ongoing. In terms of that, we're adding investors all the time. We do have a limit on the number that we can accept, but at the moment we haven't hit that. And it's each season we add more musicals to the roster, so it's a self-perpetuating model that we've put together.
Years ago, the business plan was that a producer would technically get nothing. I mean, yes, office expenses, but nothing until the investment was paid back. And then he received 50% of the profits, with the other 50% going to the limited partners. Is that the way it's still done today?
To a degree. I mean, that 50% is divided amongst the other producers, though. So if you're the lead producer and you have producers, co-producers under you, then you have to share that with them, of course, to incentivize them to bring on investors and that sort of thing. But it is typically that the producers don't get anything until the show recoups, which makes it, of course, riskier for the producers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the traditional general partnership model, that we have limited partners and the general partner, and they break the pie up in half and run that in there. The Broadway Consortium, are you strictly looking at qualified investors? Or are you opening up to, Ken Davenport did the Godspell investing in a non-traditional fashion, where he took lots of people who didn't need to submit financial statements?
Well, that was a unique situation, because he actually became a registered broker to be able to do that. So he could accept, as low as, I think, $1,000, I think, was his minimum. But that was a different scenario. And for us, they do have to be what you call qualified, or I call accredited, but it's a different qualification that somebody has to go through.
So model. When you heard of this, did you say, wow, that's so smart, I wish I'd thought of that, or, gee, that's good for Ken, but not for me?
Well, I was anxiously waiting to see how that went for him, because I thought it was, he's one of those who always thinks outside the box, and he sure does.
Genius. Yeah.
He's a marketing genius. So I always follow with great interest anything he does. Mm-hmm. In the end, I mean, it was so much work that he went through. It's hard to say, if that could be replicated easily, because he really put a lot of effort into getting his license to be able to do that and all that. And, it's tough, but the rules are changing all the time. And now with things like Kickstarter and Rocket Hub, the laws are starting to catch up, and they're coming up with different ways to do financing of the arts. So I think over time it'll evolve a bit.
So what you had mentioned those recording projects. What else have you got on the horizon as far as producing?
Well, there are some new shows that we're looking at, including some that we're developing ourselves. We've lead produced in the past and developed shows, and it's something that we're starting to do again with the new company. We have one that's based on Lizzie Borden that's actually doing a concert this week at Ars Nova as a kind of a preview. And it's a four-woman rock musical version of Lizzie Borden. And then we also have some projects that are targeting Broadway for next season, including Matilda, which we'll be involved with, probably not technically as a producer, because they're limiting that to the lead producers, but we will be involved. And also looking at some others, such as Cinderella.
So what do people want to see these days? Do you have any sense of it? After doing this for a few years now, have you said, I've got it, I know what people want to see, or I know what people don't want to see? Is it either one? Have you been able to glean anything like that, or are you just as much in the dark as everybody else when it comes to that question?
Well, I think certainly can't necessarily predict trends, because obviously once something becomes a trend, then it's already passe by the time somebody else comes out with something. So I think it's more of just doing really quality work, something that if you have good taste, which I like to believe I pick good material, then I would think that other people would want to see it too. And it's just a matter of picking things that you feel are really quality pieces that you can get behind, and then just go for it and put your all into it. But I don't think there's any particular formula that anybody can can point to. If there were, then there would be a lot of really rich producers.
Now, with Bonnie and Clyde, there's Frank Wildhorn's name attached to it, and he's lost a lot of money for a lot of people. Were there people saying to you, look, Van, don't get involved with Frank. Don't you see that all his shows don't pay back? How much of that was a factor in your saying, I don't care, I like this show, I'm doing it? Were you nervous about his reputation?
Well, I think I was just, you know, basing it on the material at hand. Like, I read the script and I listened to the music and I was extremely impressed with it. And we were hoping that the critics would see what we saw, but, you know, obviously they weren't as kind as we were hoping. But I think it's kind of come upon a renaissance too. And once the album came out and more people had a chance to hear it, I've had a lot of people come up to me and say that they felt it closed prematurely and it was a really quality work. And I think a lot of people felt like we got a bum deal. I think part of it was timing too. Opening in December is always a challenge. We had a low enough, you know, running cost that we thought we'd be able to make it through that, but December is always a tough time to open.
So in the future, will you be reluctant to open a show in December?
I would definitely be more reluctant unless I thought it had such a brand name attached to it that it could weather that no matter what.
Or if it was a Christmas show.
Or if it was a Christmas show, definitely.
Great. Well, Van, anything else you want to share with us that we haven't talked about tonight?
Nothing off the top of my head. I mean, we've covered some pretty good ground. Unless there's any other questions that you had.
No, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. It's so exciting to have someone who is young and interested in Broadway and is spending time, effort, and money on the art. And we really appreciate it. We hope you come back and visit us when you have something else coming up.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Good night.
All right. You too. Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So, Peter, anything exciting coming up for you this week you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Chaplin because
Laura
is somebody I've followed since he was in college at Montclair State University in New Jersey. And I've really seen him do a lot of nice things over the year. I've also seen him write a musical that I think was awfully good. So, and the word of mouth is that he is sensational beyond belief. So I'm really looking forward to seeing him on Wednesday night. I'm also going to Forbidden Broadway too this week. So I'm looking forward to that as well because it's been a while since we've seen that, needless to say. So those are at least two of the things I'm seeing this week. And that's my story so far.
Great. We look forward to the reviews and reports next week. Next week, we're going to be recording on Sunday morning where Bob Avian's going to join us. And we'll talk a little bit about what's going on with him. And Michael will be back and we'll be the Three Musketeers plus Bob once again. So I guess that's about it. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time a new episode of This Week on Broadway comes out, you can automatically download it to iTunes. If you do subscribe to us in iTunes, please go to iTunes and leave us some feedback and give us a 5-star rating because those ratings really help Apple decide who they're going to promote in the iTunes store. And the more that they promote us, the more we can have people discover This Week on Broadway. You could also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. You could also listen to us on applications on your smartphones like Stitcher. Stitcher is an app that allows you to stream This Week on Broadway directly to your phone. If you want to get in touch with us, go to BroadwayRadio.com. There's information for Peter, Michael, and myself, Twitter, Facebook, phone numbers, all different ways to reach out and get in touch with us and let us know what your thoughts are. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, who's out this week, my name is James Marino, and I want to thank you for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good evening.
Good night.